All right, this is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We have another packed show for you today. It's a very serious show, and it's one that I'm really looking forward to bringing to you.
At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with a man named David Freeman, and we're going to be talking with him about Charlottesville and why there are only two sides in this fight. Okay, and that's actually something he's made some pretty important points out in light of the kind of what broke out in Charlottesville. All right, and it's a very important conversation we'll be having.
Before that, we'll be hearing an interview I did with Matt Ruskin, the writer and director of a new feature film, Crown Heights, which is in theaters all over the U.S. right now. It tells the story of Colin Warner, a young black man framed by police for murder and locked up for more than 20 years. And it also tells of the struggle of his best friend and others on the outside to gain his freedom. And it is also the story of the system that has carried out the mass incarceration of black and brown people, a slow genocide backed up and intensified by the highest levels of this system.
But opening the show up, I'm really pleased to welcome to the show
Trevor Timm. Trevor Timm is a co-founder and the executive director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation. He is a journalist, activist, and lawyer who writes a weekly column for The Guardian on privacy, free speech, and national security. He has contributed to The Atlantic, Al Jazeera, Foreign Policy, Harvard Law and Policy Review, PBS, Media Shift, and Politico. We'll talk about the Trump regime and their attacks on the press, including Attorney General Jeff Sessions' recent threats against journalists and their sources. So let's hear the interview I did recently with Trevor Timm.
All right, recently, and actually ever since the emergence of Trump onto the national political scene and and all the fascism associated with it and his attacks on the press being a major manifestation of all this, it's been very pressing, I think, for people to actually try and figure out what the hell is going on, knowing that it's somewhat dangerous, but trying to figure out, well, what the hell is going on? What exactly is happening? What's going on? And how can you do anything about this? And recently, my assistant producer came along and had found a piece that he really thought was important to read, and it was a piece by Trevor Timm. And Trevor is the executive director of Freedom of the Press Foundation and a columnist with The Guardian. Trevor, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Sure. I want to jump into this right away because I think we're going to be here for quite a while. So let's talk about this. You wrote an essay about Sessions, Jeff Sessions' threats against the press, and it was very important for a lot of people, even thinking, looking at this and thinking superficially, okay, you get it. Sessions is this. He's not, he's completely all the way through dedicated fascist, but you don't know exactly how deep it goes. You wrote a very important piece about Sessions and the threat that he poses and what it means. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Jeff Sessions has pretty much every week decided to go after one group or another when it comes to their civil rights and civil liberties. But I think one of the really vital issues that only got a bit of attention briefly, mainly because, he does this all the time, but it's his concerted effort to go after the press and their sources. When we think about the Trump administration, Donald Trump is out there pretty much every day of the week, insulting the press, calling them fake news, saying that they're enemies of the people. Yet they are, for all their faults, the best way that we have to hold the Trump administration to account and figure out what they're doing behind closed doors. And what Sessions announced a few weeks ago was essentially a crackdown on journalism, saying that they were going to go after journalist sources harder than ever before, that they were going to potentially subpoena them to testify against their sources in court. And there's even been talk about them, or at least they haven't denied that they may actually go after journalists directly and try to prosecute them. And so I think this has been an incredibly disturbing development that really says a lot about the Trump administration, given how much the press has kind of been a thorn in their side.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you say that he's a big part of this is that what you're talking about is he actually does. He spends a lot of time. One, I mean, it's true. Trump has this thing where he's talking about, the fake media, the fake press, all this stuff, the lying media, all of these things. And you've actually made an argument that there's been some very specific things that are actually going on behind the scenes with this. And the things that Trump and Sessions have been attacking are extremely serious in relation to just the existence of a press that can actually, reveal, basically hold some feet to the fire and reveal oftentimes, and frankly, it's not oftentimes not enough, but it's actually very important that people do have these. There is this actually thing operating in the society where they can actually expose these things. And some of the stuff that has been exposed around Trump has been very important. Let's talk about that a little. What is it? What's actually been going on there? What is it that he's been aimed at really hitting?
Well, I mean, when you think about it, the Republican Party now controls all three branches of government. If you include the Supreme Court, they have both houses of Congress, and they obviously have the White House. And the First Amendment is really supposed to act as the safety valve when it comes to accountability in government, that the press has the right to publish even information that the government considers classified. And we have seen story after story after story during the first 7 months of the Trump administration showing that the Trump administration is lying about one issue or another, exposing all of these controversial policies before they come out and sometimes forcing them to be reversed, and giving the American people all this information about the criminal investigations into the Trump administration itself. And we wouldn't have any of this information if it wasn't for the media and the sources who are willing to put their lives at risk by giving it to them. And so naturally, given that the press is the primary driver in holding the Trump administration accountable, that the Trump administration wants to go after them with all of the powers of the FBI and the Justice Department. And this is where things could take a very dark turn over the next 6 months of the year. If they start using the Justice Department's power to prosecute people who are giving information to the press, to conduct surveillance of journalists, to force them into court and potentially into jail, we may have a whole new situation where, you know, the American people don't find anything out about what the Trump administration is doing, and it becomes much, much harder to even force Congress to do the little that they're doing now.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things I wanted to ask you about, and it's because it's for a lot of people, they just see things in broken up into little segments. And one of the things I got from reading the stuff that you've run on this is actually this idea that when you watch what Trump is doing, that it's, you know, this thing of going after leakers is one thing, and, you know, people that are actually revealing secrets, you know, and things that are happening that are actually necessary for people to know. And as you say, you know, it's going to be a pretty dark world when people do not have access to the kinds of things that we really need to have in terms of understanding, you know, one, not just what the people that rule the society are doing, but also what people are being called on to do in the interests of humanity, in the interests of stopping just the criminal assault on everything from the environment to whole peoples. I wanted to ask you this. When you watch Trump, there's a vicious way, you know, there's a way that he has carried this whole thing out. There's a whole lot of expressions of what you were just talking about. And when you watch him, there's a very vicious way that he goes after reporters at a press conference at Trump Tower or the rally in Phoenix, which was, you know, really can only be described as sort of a Nuremberg rally. There's something that he goes out there, something that no other president in recent memory anyway has done. Let's talk about some of the broad elements of the anti-press strategy as you see them before we get into anything else.
Yeah, I mean, you know, every president in modern history has criticized the press in one way or another, but it certainly seems that Trump has taken it to a whole new level, where he is, you know, at campaign rallies, making whole sections of his speech about even individual members of the press, actually calling out people by name. I mean, there was a rally last Tuesday in Phoenix where he called journalists, quote, sick people who don't like our country. And quote, they're trying to take away our history and our heritage. He's basically calling them anti-American and has even referred to them as the, quote, enemy of the American people. And the reason that he's doing this is because he is trying to delegitimize reporters so much in his supporters' eyes that when these damning stories come out about him, that he wants a large segment of the population to never even consider whether these stories are actually true, to almost dismiss them before they even read them. And if he can get, you know, his 35 or 40% of his the country who supports him to totally discount the press, then it doesn't matter in some respects what they end up finding out about it and what they end up publishing. And so it's certainly a concerted strategy on his part to, you know, help his cause. But what it's really doing is kind of destroying the fabric of the First Amendment and the traditions we have of a free press in this country. And depending on how he takes this fight, we could be in for some dark days ahead.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and today we're talking with Trevor Timm. Trevor is the executive director of Freedom of the Press Foundation, and he's a columnist with The Guardian newspaper. You know, one of the things I was thinking about, too, is that, you know, when you think about this, Obama, for instance, there's been a this is not unprecedented in terms of there's never been these attacks on the press. And one of the things that, you know, that I found in some of the stuff that you've written in other places is that Obama himself, the Obama administration, actually laid the foundation for a lot of what Trump is doing. Can you explain that, how that played out, and then what's the difference between what Obama was doing and what Trump is doing?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think this is actually one of the most tragic parts of the Obama legacy. You know, he came in to office in 2008 and 2009, actually campaigning on protecting whistleblowers and being the most transparent administration ever. But what happened... And with Obama, it was really kind of behind the scenes and low-key. You know, his Justice Department ended up prosecuting more sources of journalists than any other administration in history. There were several scandals in his first administration and the beginning of the second where they were spying on journalists. For example, they were spying on 20 Associated Press phone lines that affected over 100 reporters in one case. And it was incredibly damaging to press freedom. But this largely happened without the kind of bombast and rhetoric that Trump is using now. You know, it wasn't like Obama was going out in campaign rallies and insulting members of the press ad hominem. And so it didn't receive as much of attention. And now, you know, we're certainly seeing Trump take the rhetoric to the next level. But if he decides to go forward with this legal crackdown on sources and journalists, it will largely be on the back of precedent that was established during the Obama administration. And certainly, if they go down this road, I think that the Obama Justice Department will share at least part of the blame for normalizing this type of behavior. Now, Trump could also take this to the next level in the legal sense, you know, bringing even more prosecutions and even going after journalists directly. But I certainly do think that the Obama administration will share a part of the blame when this inevitable crackdown happens.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things, too, that comes out after all this is, you know, there is this point of Trump actually did, when you look at what Trump did, he actually did ask Comey to jail whistleblowers. And that was a fairly important step in relation to, you know, what's been going on in relation to people who are leaking things to the press and people even being able to or feeling confident enough that they can bring something that they think is essential, you know, for the citizenry to know and to understand about. That's actually something that has been sort of sacred for a long time, even though presidents weren't, you know, always happy about it. The kind of assault that was that's been unleashed against this is very, very heavy. And I think I'd like to talk about that a little bit because it's actually a place where Trump can swing a very large hammer and cause a lot of damage in relation to this, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, there has been a general consensus that even if the U.S. government decides to go after the sources of journalists, and the sources of information, and try to put them in jail. Well, I personally think that that's very disturbing and shouldn't be done either. There has been this consensus that going after the journalists directly and throwing them in jail would be a violation of the First Amendment. But as you said, we know that actually that Donald Trump had a conversation with the fired FBI director, James Comey, where he implored the FBI director to, quote, jail journalists. And, you know, there is a law on the books, the Espionage Act, which is 100 years old and was written during World War I to go after spies and saboteurs, which has kind of been warped into this anti-leaking law, which is written so broadly that it actually could be used, if you take the letter of the law, to go after not only journalists, but everybody who reads information in the newspaper that the government considers secret. And so this is an incredibly dangerous and, in my mind, unconstitutional law, but one which, if the Trump administration wants to take this fight to the next level, they could try to use. against journalists. And it would be incredibly dangerous, not just for these sources, but for the hundreds and hundreds of reporters in the country who report on this information all the time.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and today we're talking with Trevor Timm. Trevor is the executive director of Freedom of the Press Foundation, and he's a columnist with The Guardian newspaper. And really to think, too, about the impact. I mean, think about all the things, all the major things that have happened in the world over these, you know, at least, you know, over the last, you know, who knows how many years. But I'm talking about even within my lifetime, which spans a number of decades. Let's just leave it at that. But, it, you know, the idea that so much that was revealed that actually helped people understand some of how the system operates and also can come to conclusions about what they needed to do in the face of that. And without this kind of, you know, ability to learn about what was actually happening, it's sort of, you have something that is a model of the various, you know, the basically the archetypal fascist regime, the thing that actually says that the hammer and the gun, and that's it. Shut up and keep your head down, do work, obey everything, and chew your Cheerios and everything will be fine. Just don't worry about it. I mean, it's a very heavy thing developing here.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that a lot of people aren't aware of how much information that the government actually considers secret. You know, it's not just nuclear codes and covert operatives. It is a giant wealth of information that encompasses basically everything the government does in foreign policy and national security. And, you know, when you think back to, like you said, pretty much all of the major investigations that journalists have done in our lifetime, whether we're talking about the Pentagon Papers during the Nixon administration, warrantless wiretapping during the Bush administration, CIA torture during the Bush administration, drone strikes, the Snowden, Edward Snowden NSA disclosures during Obama, all of this stuff, you know, a lot of people consider outright illegal, yet the government thinks that they can keep it secret from the American public. And we have to understand that without the ability of reporters to report on this type of information, the U.S. government could get away with literally anything that they wanted by just stamping a top secret logo on the top of documents. And the First Amendment is meant to protect us against that threat.
Mm-hmm. So just speaking brutally and frankly, where the hell are we?
Well, I think it's honestly too early to tell. You know, the Trump is obviously going out there with fire and brimstone, again, insulting various journalists pretty much every day. And the Justice Department held this high-profile press conference where they said that they were going to start put the wheels in motion to start these investigations. But honestly, because they are done in secret, we may not know the results until 6 months or a year from now. When all of these cases actually start to come to light, that's the problem with these leak investigations, is they're inherently secret. And you know, in the Obama administration, they did most of the worst of what they did was during the first term. Yet we didn't really find out about everything that happened until the second term. So you know, I think it remains to be seen. And, you know, may not be seen for 6 months or a year, but it's important that people are aware of what's going on so that when it does come, that there can be a large protest against.
Mm-hmm. I have 1.5 more questions for you, and it's been really interesting. We're going to have you back again soon. But throughout all of this and everything you've been talking about and the things I've been thinking about since reading about this, you know, this idea of, you know, what Trump is doing in terms of seeking to create a narrative of false victimhood in relation to the U.S. and the rest of the world, in relation to his own presidency and the rest of humanity. And but there's something that's always there's something that you can pretty much rely on stepping up around that, which is that it's all contradicted by the truth, by the actual real truth, which sometimes the press helps to expose and other times it doesn't. Other times it becomes part of the problem. And I'd like to know your thoughts on how this creates the kind of necessity that this creates for going after the necessity that's created by the situation in terms of going after the real press that's standing up and exposing things that people need to know in a dangerous world like today.
Well, actually, you know what? I think that's kind of one of the interesting things or byproducts of Trump's war on the press. You know, as you mentioned, you know, a lot of times journalists are responsible for exposing the truth, but in other cases, they can help perpetuate falsehoods. I mean, think back to the Iraq War and all of the reporting done that really helped the Bush administration make its case for weapons of mass destruction, which turned out to be totally false. But what Trump has done by insulting and castigating and prodding and threatening journalists is that they, in large part, no longer have this symbiotic relationship with the government where they are, you know, issuing press releases for what the government wants to say. They are actually doing aggressive, hard-hitting reporting on the Trump administration, the likes of which we haven't seen in a long time. And so what Trump is really doing could end up backfiring on him. You know, all of his troubles, whether we're talking about the Russia investigation or all of his advisors being forced to resign one after another, or any of the other conflicts that he's been involved in, really stem from reporting that the press has been able to do, given that Congress has shown no interest in exercising its oversight capabilities. And so, in a way, we'll see how this plays out, but it could be that Trump ends up digging his own grave by taking this incredibly confrontational stance. And I think it would be quite poetic if that's where we end up in 2 years.
If we have 2 years, I'm a little worried about this guy, and how, you know, not a little, very, very, very worried about this guy. Trevor, I want to know just beforehand, I want you to let people know different resources that you can fill them in on. Like, for instance, your Twitter, your website, other websites you might think important for people to go to.
Yeah, absolutely. So Freedom of the Press Foundation's website is freedom.press. And I would go there and check out what we do. We write about these issues a lot. We actually just launched a major new project. It's called the U.S. Press Freedom Tracker. And you can get there by going to pressfreedomtracker.us. And what we're doing with this Press Freedom Tracker is, for the first time, comprehensively documenting every journalist arrest and border stop and surveillance order and camera seizure and a whole host of other press freedom violations inside the U.S. You know, we often think of, you know, the U.S. as having the most protective free speech rights in the world, but what's happened is that this environment has created a situation where all of these things are on the rise. And so we want to document that as comprehensively as possible. And so if you're interested in news on this front, please go there and sign up for our newsletter. And so we can keep everyone more informed and hopefully prevent the situation from spiraling even more out of control than it already has.
All right, Trevor, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And we'll definitely be back in touch with you, man, because we got to keep following this up. It's extremely important. All right?
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, definitely, man. Thanks. Take care now.
See you.
Bye. All right, I've just been talking with Trevor Timm, Executive Director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation and writer for The Guardian. In addition to the websites he mentioned, you can follow Trevor on Twitter, at Trevor Timm, and his last name is spelled T-I-M-M. Once again, that's T as in Tom, I-M-M. As always, I will post all the links on my Facebook page. We're going to take a quick break and be right back, so stay tuned.
Blue-eyed son, oh, where have you been, my darling young one? I've stumbled on the side of 12 misty mountains. I've walked and I've crawled on 6 crooked highways. I've stepped in of 7 sad forests. I've been out in front of 12 dead oceans. I've been 10,000 miles in the mouth of a graveyard, and it's hard, and it's hard, and it's hard, and it's hard, it's a hard.
Fall.
All right, that was Joan Baez's cover of A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall. Before we hear the interview with Matt Ruskin, I'd like to give you a chance to hear the trailer for the film, and then we'll go right to the interview after that.
If you focus on your breathing, it'll bring you out of your mind and back into your body.
Come on, come on. Come on.
Just know that you are not alone.
Crime today is an American epidemic.
There ain't no killer.
The system doesn't work for people who can't afford to defend themselves.
The whole neighborhood know what happened. The whole neighborhood know you grabbed the wrong guy.
I'm an innocent man!
I don't know you the way a mother should know her son.
Everyone saying you did something. After a while, you start to question yourself.
I'll work for free if you take a look at his case.
How are we gonna afford this?
You want me to leave him?
They gonna keep me in here until I say I kill that man. You know I would die before I do that.
We're gonna keep fighting for you.
You got your family, you got your life. Why are you still wasting your time on me?
It's not just about you. It's bigger than that.
Colin Warner lived in Texas
or Louisiana. He would have been executed long ago.
Longer sentences, more prisons.
They took everything from me.
More police.
Everything.
I can't just pretend this situation doesn't exist.
Well, this situation exists too.
The truth is going to come out.
Can't leave an innocent man in jail.
I'm gonna take you home. It's just a matter of time.
Okay, I'm pleased to welcome to the show Matt Ruskin.
Matt Ruskin is the writer and director of a powerful new film, a film that's just really an incredible film. I've actually watched it two or three times, really was moved by it. It's a film about the case of Colin Warner, and he's a young black man framed by the police in New York City for murder and locked up for 20 years, a story all too common at a time of slow genocide for black people, a slow genocide that could easily be an all-out genocide. And I'm really pleased to welcome Matt to the show. Matt, welcome.
Thanks, Michael. Great to be here.
Yeah. Let's talk about this. What, I mean, this is a film that actually, when I'm watching it, and like I said, I watched it three times and I kept thinking each time got a little bit more, but it was also each time it got hard. It got hard, you know, because it sinks in deeper and deeper. And I want to ask you, what compelled you to make this film and, you know, go in the direction that you went with it?
Yeah. I first heard their story on This American Life, which, is this documentary radio show on public radio, and they're incredible storytellers, and I try and listen to everything that they do. And they did a piece about Colin and Carl, which featured just a lot of recordings with them talking about their experience. And I was just completely blown away, not only by what they had been through, but how they handled themselves. You know, for Colin Warner to emerge from 21 years of wrongful incarceration with his humanity and his dignity, and to come out of it without bitterness or spite, it sounded superhuman. You know, it's just such an extraordinary, he's just such an extraordinary person. And then for Carl King, his friend, who spent more than two decades fighting for Colin's freedom, this is a guy who really, when everybody else gave up, he decided that, you know, he couldn't live in a world where an innocent guy could be left to die in prison. And I think that propelled him, you know, over those 21 years. So I was just, you know, these issues are really important to me, but as a filmmaker, I wasn't setting out to make a movie about the criminal justice system initially. I was just so taken with these two guys. I thought they were so remarkable that I became really passionate about wanting to tell their story.
You know, what really sort of struck me too is that there's a point where, I guess, actually, what's her name? Natalie Paul, who plays Antoinette, who is eventually, she's Colin's partner. And she made this point that I thought it really sort of struck me, because she said that it took her a while. And she realized at a certain point that the problem is that you think of the people who are in the situation that Colin was in as not being part of society. And therefore, you don't see them. They don't really matter. They don't exist. And yet, what came through, even as you're showing that in terms of Colin's sinking or being buried in the prison system and fighting against it, but still nonetheless being in the midst of this hellhole. And yet the more you watch that, the more his humanity emerges. And I thought that was, and the more pressing you feel about, get this man out. And it's sort of, you know, that you're like yelling for justice. And then at the same time, you're realizing that this is happening to, you know, to countless numbers of people.
Yeah, countless people. I think one of the things that was so extraordinary about his story, and I'm sure is true of many others, is that he was arrested when he was 18 years old. He was ripped out of his life, and he was a kid. And he was not only a kid, but he had only been in the United States for 2 years. He had emigrated from Trinidad. And so you have this guy who's not only trying to figure out who he is as a person, but was still, you know, assimilating to the United States and that huge transition. And then you put him in one of the harshest environments imaginable. And for him to really become such a grounded and compassionate human being in that environment is just, you know, unbelievable to me. And something that is, you know, really central to the film and what has honestly been life-changing for me, just being around Colin and spending so much time with him over the last few years, just to see somebody who had that level of strength and, you know, was able to live his life in such a principled way. One of the aspects of this story that really blew me away was that after serving 15 years, he came up for parole, and all he had to do, according to the state, was take responsibility for this crime. And he decided that he would rather die in prison than validate their conviction and express remorse for a crime that he didn't commit. And as a result, he spent many more years in prison, not knowing that there would be any end to this. And I just, the clarity and the conviction in that, I thought, it just really made an impression on me. And I think is, you know, really my goal for this film was to humanize these issues and tell the story in the most human way possible and let people walk away from it, drawing their own sort of commentary about these overarching issues.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's a way that, even in what you're just saying, there's a way that actually when you're talking about what Colin does and the stand, the moral stand and the brave stand that he took and actually the standing for the truth, basically. I mean, it's sort of like, okay, I could just cop to this. And so many people, you know, I'm sure millions of people, because they're, you know, this is the scale that this is on throughout across the country. Millions and millions of people probably cop to something lesser so they can just get done, get out. And, you know, that's sort of a way that this sort of, when you step back a minute and you look at this, that's a way that that even in Colin's case, that this sort of this soul grinding, body grinding machine keeps on rolling on and eating people up. So it becomes, in a real sense, it actually becomes, when people disappear into the prisons, they're cut off from everything, it becomes an actual genocide. It becomes an actual genocide in terms of when you're looking at who's being hit. Black and brown people, who's, you know, what's happening to them? They're disappearing inside the prisons. I mean, that's the one thing that Colin kept sort of asserting his humanity as a way, in a certain way, of not disappearing inside the prison, even though everyone around him, it was actually, there was an element of just they became prisoners. They became something other than what they were when they, before they got into these jails.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that you could convict somebody with no physical evidence based solely on the discredited testimony of a child who was railroaded by police. I don't think you could do that. I don't think all the adults in the room, the prosecutors, the detectives could do that if you don't dehumanize the person you're doing it to. And I think that is true throughout the rest of his experience in the prison system. And I would imagine that there are countless people who don't have advocates on the outside, like Carl King, who just never gave up, or a woman like Antoinette, who devoted herself to fighting for his freedom. And so, in a way, you know, this story is not just about his experience in prison, but the experience of the people who loved him and held steadfast in their fight to get him out of prison.
Mm-hmm.
This is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. I'm speaking today with Matt Ruskin, the writer and director of a powerful and artistically mind-blowing new film called Crown Heights.
You know, one thing that came up to my mind each time I saw the film was the Central Park Five, because it wasn't that great a distance between what happened to Colin and the Central Park Five and what happened to them. I mean, it's a decade, but it's like, you know, the same thing's going on. People were still being fed as grist into the mill. And there was a lot of similarities, you know, the demonization of the Central Park Five and the whole way that the system came out against them. And then, you know, that has sort of maybe a louder, but it is actually a very much tied to what happened to Colin.
Yeah, I think what I take from that is just rejecting the notion that this was like one bad apple detective. There's just too many cases of the, you know, similar to Collins. When I was scouting locations in Brooklyn, I would walk around and tell people, you know, what we were doing. And I would just describe his case, you know, in very general terms, saying that it was a film about that. And then they would say, oh, I heard about that guy. And then they would describe a different case. And that really hit me, how really it's an everyday occurrence. And while I was writing the script, the New York Times ran a whole investigative series about a different homicide detective from South Brooklyn who had something like 50 murder convictions, 12 of which, you know, there was the same eyewitness who he had paid for her testimony. And so the Brooklyn DA at the time had opened up a review of his convictions and hundreds of others. And, you know, within the first few months, they had exonerated something like a dozen people. So this story is really just a drop in the bucket.
Mm-hmm. You know, I had a friend a while back who used to refer to prisons as modern day slave ships. And I kept thinking about that because when you're looking at things like, for instance, the three presidents that each one tried to sort of up the ante of the one before them in terms of, you know, talking about and supporting this kind of suppression, oppression, and repression, and then and people like Pataki, you have all of these things, and it was kind of against that. This is where I thought actually the what Colin did, but then also what Carl and Antoinette did, which you were pointing to before. These were three voices that were fighting to stand up against the dehumanization and actually had to go up against a lot in society, you know, with, you know, lawyers being, you know, these lawyers that actually were, you know, just bozos and couldn't really handle anything. You had one scene in there where a guy was just like, you just felt like getting up and walking to the screen and slapping his head a couple thousand times because the kind of thing that was going on there where it was just like, it was just it's grist through the mill. And when I keep thinking about that, again, as I was saying, the Central Park Five, and then you look at what was going on in the robbing of the humanity, and the idea that this is, you know, this is a sort of ongoing thing where people's humanity is stolen from them, and that is the equivalent of a genocide.
Yeah, it was really eye-opening to go back and look at the political rhetoric from, you know, Reagan, Bush 1, and Clinton, who were all in office while Colin was in prison, and to look at their policies, you know, with respect to being, quote unquote, tough on crime. And to look at it, you know, for me personally, to look at it for the first time through the eyes of somebody whose life hung in the balance, it took on an entirely different sense of urgency. George Pataki in 1995, when he was governor at his inaugural speech, which we include in the film, he talks about how, you know, if he has his way politically, he'll bring back the death penalty and he wants to abolish work release and parole for violent offenders. And he succeeded in large part in doing, you know, the latter. The 24% of violent offenders who are eligible for parole were released in the early 90s, 1991. And then by 1998, when he had been in office for 3 years, that number went down to 8%. And Colin was one of those people, you know, a violent offender who was denied parole.
Mm, boy. Well, we have time for just, I think there might be two more, but we're going to have to push this. And I want to get to at the end. I want people to know where your film is playing. And I really want people to rush out there and see this damn thing. See it a couple of times and then take everybody you know. Let's jump into this. There's a point here where when we're talking about all this stuff that goes on, and, you know, I thought that there's a phrase that comes up a couple of times from Colin that says, please don't let it be a cell. And it's this plea as he's sort of coming out of sleep. But every time it's sort of, you know, just just in a very painful way, he's confronted with the sounds of prison, with the sights of prison, with the reality of prison. And I thought that was a really, really important way of bringing to people what this actually means.
Yeah, he told me that he said this prayer. He would hear the morning bell or buzzer go off, and he would hear the sounds of the prison. But before he opened his eyes, he would say that prayer. Because as he always says, you know, this felt like a nightmare that he was living, that he just hoped he would wake up from one day. And that really made an impression on me, and it was something I really wanted to find a way to work into the film.
Mm-hmm. And you did, man. You did really, really well. It's haunted me since watching this, and it's sort of, I think it actually is a thing that people have to take into account. And again, I mean, this idea of the through line, and even, you know, just leaving aside the poetry of the, you know, the prisons being slave ships, except they don't float, but they're filled with the same kind of social, you know, repression that was there in a general sense, and also oftentimes in a real sense, what happens there. And I wanted you to actually talk to me just for 1 minute or so, that when you look at this, what do you see as the most important thing in relationship to what people need to know about what happened here?
For me, it's just understanding that these are human beings with families, you know, who were a part of a community, guilty or not, when these people are ripped out of their lives and put in these incredibly harsh environments. You know, there is an element to all of it that is inhumane. But with respect to Colin's story in particular, it is just really, my goal is that people watch this film, maybe who haven't thought a lot about these issues, and walk away thinking about the human toll that these are people that we're doing this to on a mass scale. And that's really the goal with the film, is that people could walk away having put themselves in the shoes of Colin and Carl and his wife and all the people affected by this, you know, for an hour and a half.
And the massive numbers of people with the genocidal toll continuing to rise, and the massive numbers of people that continue to be thrown into prison. There are probably millions and millions. There's probably millions of Collins either waiting to happen or having happened already. And your film is going to be a tremendous, tremendous asset to people trying to stand up against this and trying to understand what's happening, but also trying to stand up against it and popularize why this has got to end. So thank you very much for this, okay?
Thank you very much. Appreciate
sure, man.
It.
Sure, man. And we'll talk to you again, I hope. So take care.
I hope so.
Bye now.
Take care. Thanks.
All right. That was Matt Ruskin, and he is the writer and director of a powerful new film called Crown Heights, a very important film for anyone who gives a damn about what's going on in the world today. They've got to see this. It's a powerful new film about the case of Colin Warner, a young black man framed by police for murder and locked up for 20 years, which is all too common, okay, in a time of slow genocide for black people and people. And it's the story of Colin's friends who stood up for him and fought for decades to bring out the truth. And as you may have noticed, we didn't actually talk about where the film is playing, but it's playing everywhere. Check your local listings. And you can find news of special events like appearances by the director and cast members on Twitter at Crown Heights MOV. And that's at Crown Heights, capital M, capital O, capital V. We're going to take a break and be right back, so stay tuned.
There's something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop. Children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speaking their minds are getting so much resistance from behind. I think it's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
All right, welcome back. That was Buffalo Springfield with a very appropriate song for this next segment, For What It's Worth.
Now, we're going to be joined by David Freeman. And David actually is someone that my assistant producer came across David's a thing that David wrote. And he said, wow, you've got to check this out because there's all this, you know, argument going on about the different forces in the movement against the Trump regime and which one is doing what and who's doing what to who and, you know, how do you confront the white supremacists and all this? How do you confront the Nazis? And David had something really unique to add to this. And so I want to just welcome David Freeman to the show. First off, David, hi, how are you?
Hi, good to speak with you.
You too, man. Well, let's jump into this. What is it that you wrote this piece? And it starts out with the wrong story is being reported, and even progressives are complicit in perpetuating a false narrative. There are only two sides to this. The white supremacists and their Republican enablers are the wrong side. Everyone else needs to pull together despite our differences. What prompted that?
Well, I received a call from clergy in Charlottesville to come to Charlottesville and help them defend against this onslaught of Nazis that they have. I am not religious myself, but I have found that I am really drawn to people of faith who are serious about it and who are serious activists. So I went up to Charlottesville to help them. When I went there, like many people, I had a very poor impression of Antifa. And in the course of standing with these clergy arm in arm against Nazis, we had experiences that opened our minds and hearts to a better perspective on what they were doing. And so I came away from it with a realization that, well, there's just one clear and present evil which all good people should be able to agree upon, and that's white supremacy. And I realized that we have been fighting each other over tactics with as great or greater ferocity than we use against the white supremacists themselves. You know, and I've been guilty of that in the past, but after Antifa and Black Lives Matter saved our lives, I realized that they have a role different from mine. I am absolutely nonviolent, but I respect them and their opposition to white supremacy, and we need to work together and beside each other rather than interfering with each other's fight.
Mm-hmm. You know, one thing I was going to ask you about is that there's a, you basically say that one, that what you were left with in relation to this, when you were, you know, basically literally put in the middle of an ocean of Nazis, you know, and KKK. And it's sort of like, you know, the whole town under siege, all this stuff happening. And you said, we could not allow this to become the new normal, which was really important, I thought, in terms of seeing what the terms were, because it wasn't a question so much of what are your tactics? What are you going to do here? What do you think is good? What do you think is bad? You know, but there was actually an overarching question that people had to confront, which is, are you going to allow this to become the new normal? And if you do, what is that going to mean? And then what's it going to take to actually change this?
Well, when it became clear that the police were either unable or unwilling to defend their city from this onslaught of Nazis, somebody has to. Now, in my personal opinion, a massive show of nonviolent force, you know, when we show up in just enormous numbers, much larger than the Nazis, they will back down and we can protect the city. However, there are wonderful organizations like the Southern Poverty Law Center, which are encouraging people not to show up because they think that encourages the violence. But when 1,000 Nazis descend upon a town and the police do not defend them, well, the Antifa is going to show up. If we as nonviolent folks do not show up, then thank God the Antifa show up to protect these people. I'd rather it was a large number of nonviolent folks. But I'm not going to criticize the Antifa for protecting people when the police will not.
Well, really, you'd think there were enough examples through history of people who advocate capitulation under the most, you know, nice sounding and all the flowery, you know, words and all this stuff, but they just basically not showing up amounts to capitulation and amounts to opening the door to the fascists taking over, which is, you know, we've seen this movie before, you know, and that's something I thought was really powerful in what you wrote. And you said that basically you have some principles that you said. You said something about that we did not, well, actually, let me ask you this before you do this. Give people just, we have, and again, maybe 2 minutes, as much of a detailed idea as you can, to 3 minutes. We'll give you 3 minutes, all right? As much of a detailed explanation as you can of what was it that actually really changed your mind about your relationship with Antifa and what needed to be done? Because I thought it was really important that the last sentence of the piece you wrote said, I really don't know, but I ain't judging anybody, including Antifa, anymore at all if they're fighting for justice. Let's talk about what that was, where that came from.
Well, actually, the most important turning point for me was when 20 of us were standing, clergy, were standing on the stairs prepared to symbolically block the Nazis. And there was a large group of them coming towards us. The Antifa stepped forward to protect us. We asked them to stand down, to back up, and allow us to make our nonviolent stand, even though they and we thought we would be overrun. And they told us, you're going to be overrun. You're going to be hurt. We respect what you're doing. We will back up. They didn't want to back up. They wanted to protect us. But because they respected us for what we were trying to do, they backed up. That was them giving us respect, and I respected that, and I believe that respect breeds respect. Now, the Nazis surged forward, and we were so few that they were able to they could have gone around us. They just shoved our flank aside. None of us were hurt. If they had come straight over us, we would have been crushed. So we regrouped. And this time, a massive number of Nazis screaming, Jesus hates you, and screaming, kill the faggot priests, were charging at us. And at that point, the Antifa basically said, we've had enough, and they surged forward, and they protected us, and they stopped that charge. And I sincerely believe that when they surged forward, they were moving forward to fight, to defend us with love in their hearts that was greater than their hatred for the Nazis. So I respect that, and they showed respect to us. That's what changed my heart.
Okay, David Freeman.
Nonviolent.
Okay. David Freeman, an activist in North Carolina, thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thank you.
Okay, take care now. All right, that was David Freeman, an activist from North Carolina and one of the courageous participants in Congregate Seville, a group of mainly clergy who confronted the Nazis in Charlottesville on August 12th. And that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank all of my guests today, Trevor Timm of the Freedom of the Press Foundation, Matt Ruskin, writer and director of the new film Crown Heights, and David Freeman. I'd also like to thank the people who worked on the show, my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and Teddy Robinson, my engineer. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. And we're going out now with a really great version of Eve of Destruction from P.E., Public Enemy. Talk to you again next week.
What's that gun you're talking? Keep it a joke. say. They can't you feel the fear that I'm feeling today. If the button is pushed, there's no running away. There'll be no one to save with the world in the grave. Take a look around at you, boy. It's bound to scare you, boy. But you tell me. Regulation, hand for citizens, pass legislation, marches alone, can't bring integration, with human respect, is disintegrating, this whole crazy world is just too frustrating, and you tell me, over, 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 again, my friend. Drums, pride and disgrace. You can bury your dead. Don't leave a trace. Hate your next door neighbor, but don't forget to say grace.